Hi, Ruska. Good morning, Jim. All of you.
Good afternoon over there.
I think we are all set here. Are you ready to start?
Ready to go.
Okay. Why don't you kick off? Or what's
okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're gonna begin our redeliberations on the gross versus net joint discussion, and so I'll turn over to the staff, Mary, to walk us through.
Yeah, thank you. So today the boards will be redeliberating changes proposed in their respective exposure drafts related to principal agent considerations. The FASB issued its proposed accounting standards update, revenue from contracts with customers, principal versus agent considerations in August, and the ISB issued its exposure draft clarifications to IFRS 15 in July. I'll start with the amendments we're asking the board to reaffirm, and then we'll move on to other topics. So first, the decisions to affirm. The first three questions in the joint memo are whether the boards would like to reaffirm amendments in their respective proposed updates to clarify the unit of account for the principal agent assessment as a specified good or service is a distinct good or service or distinct bundle of goods or services, clarify the application of the control principle in the context of services, and clarify the role of the indicators, including that the indicators assist in the evaluation of control rather than override or replace the control evaluation, how each indicator relates to the control principle, that one or more indicators may be less or more relevant to the control evaluation in different contracts, and to reframe the indicators to indicate when an entity is a principal rather than when the entity is an agent. The FASB received 21 comment letters on its proposal. The ISB received 74 comment letters on its ED, of which 62 respondents commented on the principal agent proposal. In addition, board members and the staff performed outreach with a broad range of stakeholders about the proposals. Overall, respondents were supportive of the board's proposal, citing improvements to the operability and understandability and reduced cost and complexity in applying the guidance. The staff was encouraged to learn that these stakeholders thought some of the more difficult fact patterns for which there's diversity in practice in the U.S. today could be answered by practitioners in a consistent manner under the proposed guidance. That said, despite the generally positive feedback, the staff still think there will still be a small subset of transactions, likely smaller under existing U.S. GAAP and IFRS, for which judgment will be necessary to determine whether revenue should be reported gross or net. A few respondents thought it could be difficult in some cases to determine when the specified good or service is the right to a good or service, or when it is the good or service itself. In considering the feedback, the staff acknowledged that there may be some judgment involved in identifying the specified good or services in some cases. The staff think that the examples and basis for conclusions provide some useful direction on this topic, and that this judgment is no more difficult than, and is similar to, identifying an entity's performance obligation. The staff has discussed several different topics with the TRG for which the boards and staff emphasize that significant judgment is sometimes necessary when determining the entity's performance obligation and the nature of the performance obligation. Although the boards did not propose any amendments about estimating gross revenue as a principal, several comment letter respondents provided feedback on this topic. During initial deliberations, the boards were informed of existing limited diversity in practice and transaction in which an entity is a principal in a transaction, but is and expects to remain unaware of the price charged to the customer for its goods or services by an intermediary. Each board decided not to include the issue within the scope of their respective projects, in part because stakeholders informed the boards that the issue is not pervasive in practice. In addition, an amendment for this issue might require a change to the transaction price guidance, and the boards were concerned about making a change to that guidance to address what stakeholders asserted was a narrow issue this far into the implementation process. However, both boards included some discussion and their respective basis for conclusions on this topic. Respondents provided a variety of comments related to the basis for conclusions in each board's ED. The feedback provided was very inconsistent. Some respondents preferred that the boards delete this discussion from the basis for conclusions and not mention this issue at all. Other respondents requested that the boards include this discussion in the authoritative guidance. Based on the comment letters and outreach discussions, the staff have not received any new substantive information from stakeholders that would affect the board's previous decisions not to include the issue in the scope of this project. Rather, the staff think it's important that the staff of each board work together when updating the basis for conclusion in each final standard to ensure there's some measure of consistency in the discussion and with the aim of ensuring there's no conflicting information. Both staffs are recommending that each board affirm their proposed amendments. I'll hand it over to the FASB board to discuss questions 1 through 3, then we'll turn it over to the IASB for discussion before any votes are taken, And then after the ISB discusses, the FASB will vote and the ISB will vote. So with that, I'll turn it over for 1 through 3.
And then after that, we'll do question 4. Okay. So any questions with respect to, or observations with respect to questions 1 through 3 here?
Yeah, I'll just agree with the tee-up that Mary gave. I was pretty encouraged by the comment letters and the feedback that we got. This is a very difficult area today, and people had said that the 606 wasn't all that helpful. So to get such such good support for the amendments that we proposed is pretty encouraging. I do agree with the feedback that sometimes it is hard to figure out whether the specified good or service is the underlying good or service that's being delivered or the right. I thought some of the... It took a couple of times reading the examples that you put into the memo to sort of have it sink in as to how we might be able to clarify and give people some assistance to help figure that out. But at the end of the day, it is going to be. So I'm generally supportive of your recommendations and affirming RED.
Tom?
I have no real substantive observations, but would like to get the staff's input about how you're going to help stakeholders understand two issues that were raised in the comment letter process. One of which is what Mark just talked about, the ability to distinguish between a service and a right to a service. I thought that what you put in, I believe it's paragraph 15 of the memo, was very useful in helping understand that distinction. I was first wanted to ask, are we going to try to make that clarification even more precise within the examples? Draw them along.
I think, of course, we're going to have to. It will be our goal to remain converged in this, so we'll work with Henry and his team over there as well. But in our present initial stages of thinking about what the final ASU would look like, given the feedback we've gotten, and you know, anticipating what might be the board's decisions here today, we do believe that we can factor in some of the discussion you're seeing in paragraph 15. In a shortened version into the examples, as well as build some of that thought process into the basis for conclusions. And that would be, you know, tentatively, at least the FASB staff's sort of intent to try and help people along that that path.
The second issue that was raised in the comment letters that I'd like your reaction to is some observed that one of the examples allowed us to make a control decision without you, we provide an example of making a control decision without reference to the indicators. Is that what we find acceptable? How are we going to go forward with that? It would seem to me that we have two approaches. In the paragraph that follows the indicators, we say sometimes the indicators, some are going to be more important than the others. And we could potentially end up saying there that indeed, if you were in the basis, say, if you can make a control decision absent the indicators, that's fine. But it would seem to me even in those settings, when you make a controlled decision with the indicators there, you'd want to make sure the indicators aren't contraindicators to that particular control decision. So it would seem to me in almost all circumstances, there has to be at least some consideration of the indicators. Are we going to update the examples to help people with that or address it in any way?
I mean, if you want to weigh in.
I think that's a fair point, that even if a preparer is able to look at the principle alone and you know, comfortably reach a decision, you're right that practically speaking you shouldn't completely ignore the indicators, but the point that we're trying to drive home in the examples is in response to feedback we heard from practitioners and regulators about what sometimes happens in practice today, where despite the fact that you might have a view as to whether an entity is a principal or an agent, someone might link on to one of the many indicators we have today and say, well, I'm not going to look at all the indicators. I'm going to say, well, there's one in particular that allows me to get to the answer I want. And so what we're trying to emphasize is the fact that the boards have laid out some indicators doesn't mean that they're relevant or persuasive in every case.
I think it's also important to highlight that part of what we were trying to show with an example that didn't rest entirely on the indicators was this notion we've been trying to communicate for a very long time, which is that the principle is the principle. The indicators are there to support the analysis, which must mean, at least theoretically in some cases, that the principle itself is what you're shooting at, and the indicators may not be all that relevant because they're a relatively limited set of indicators. You may look at the principle as more guiding what the appropriate outcome should be.
Perhaps in that example where we don't discuss the indicators, we can at least mention them and say they weren't all that relevant in that circumstance.
Jim?
So, like Mark and Tom, I was pleased with the input. I think there are individual fact patterns that are judgments difficult today. When you weigh all the factors, I think this helps narrow that. It's not going to eliminate the degree of judgment down to zero, nor should it, in my opinion. But I think this will be a useful tool for people to make that evaluation. The one thing that I found useful, and I didn't map the language in paragraph 20 to the basis, but it was questions asked by some commenters about significant integration. So we talk about the level at which you do the gross net evaluation, and I think some questions about, well, why is significant integration indicative that you might be gross with respect to the whole? And I thought the language in paragraph 20 was useful in that regard. I didn't map it vis-a-vis the basis. So if it's not already sort of that plainly in the basis, if we could think about whether that language in 20 could be in the basis. And it may already be there, Scott. I didn't map it.
Oh, no. It isn't. I think it's fair to say it was not mapped out in the same way in what you have seen. I will tell you that it is the staff's intent, again, working with our friends at the ISB, to, along with paragraph 15 that we just discussed, it sort of helps with that right versus service question. This is another area where we believe paragraph 20 is finding some substantive play in our draft basis as we sit now to help answer that other question that was raised. So I think you'll see what you're recommending when you see a draft.
Okay. Hans, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Any comments or questions here?
Matt?
Yes, Jung-woo? Yes.
May I ask the comment on your paper, summary of feedback, let's see.
7 hours.
Yeah, that's paragraph 18.
Of agenda paper 8?
The paper is, number 8. As is memo 8, if you see paragraph 18, in the middle of the paragraph, maybe that's at the sixth line, two respondents recommended that the board use existing terminology. That is a performance obligation instead of a specified good or service. So what is our response on this suggestion?
I'm sorry, are you asking us?
Well, I think, Chung was asking on your memo, but I mean, I think I can comment to say, I think actually the boards explained their rationale for the terminology in the basis for conclusions. And it's because, you know, as it says, I think, in this paragraph here, if you use the performance obligation terminology, then it gets confusing if you're actually an agent. So that's why we use that terminology. And maybe we can look, both of us can look at our respective wordings and the basis for conclusions just to see if there any further emphasis is needed, but we did explain the notion.
Any other comments?
Just a question, and it goes to the point that Jim Croker was raising earlier. Are we adding to our list of indicators about control this idea about the integration process? If you're performing a significant integration, is that now one of the indicators, or it's not?
It's not in the list of indicators now.
But we, I thought we were saying in the paper that it may be indicative of whether you control, right? So if that's the case,
I think it's not indicative of control. But what we explain is that's a situation in which the entity would have control of right. The board or service because it is providing the significant integration service. So that itself is not indicative of control. So.
I guess it's maybe circular. But
we use that notion to explain how you obtain control in certain situations.
Right.
So it's built into our paragraph
B35AC.
B35AC.
In the guidance.
Right.
So it's in that paragraph that is clarifying how does an entity that is a principal obtain control, because you remember a lot of people had concerns about how you actually obtain control of services.
Right.
And so we have in that paragraph, we're explaining how you get control. And it's in there, and as the paper says, it isn't, because we think it's determinative in that situation.
Okay. It's
definitive, sorry.
It's definitive of control, yeah.
I was looking for, I can't remember whether or not we had recast or relisted all of the indicators based on the feedback, but you haven't put that in here, have you?
No.
Yeah. Okay. That's why I was a bit confused as to whether or not you agreed with that comment and we're going to incorporate it, or you're just going to leave it the way it is.
Could I try on this one, Pat? I think it. My understanding is that there is no plan to revise the list of indicators to have integration, because the comments I think we got back on the exposure draft where some people were questioning, and I think this is the one that Tom was referring to, how we got immediately to the conclusion of control based on the fact pattern being significant integration services, and we were explaining how the integration services meant that the integrator had to have control of the goods and services that were used. So I think rather than considering them to be an indicator, that would almost weaken something that we have looked at as determinative. And so Tom's suggestion, I think it was on this one, was that we just make a comment about the indicators are not relevant to this example because the integration service demonstrates that you have control before you deliver them in an integrated form to the customer. So I think it's covered,
yeah.
But I don't think we were talking about including it as an indicator.
Okay. The reason why I was confused is because the definition of control doesn't have the notion of integration in it. So my conclusion was that you couldn't otherwise interpret it any other way than an indicator. Whereas if the definition had that concept in it, then I would say that it is part and parcel.
Personally, I don't think we need it, because I think the analysis in that example illustrates how the fact that you're providing significant integration
mm-hmm.
means that you have to have controlled those in order to do the integration. So I think it's more a fact pattern example than it is an indicator.
Yeah.
Like what?
Generally, I support that proposal. Only two areas of different views of concern. One relate to what Chung-Wu just said. You know, I understand the benefit to use the term called specified goods and services, but on aggregate, I really don't think it is necessary to use a new term. And secondly, you know, we try to emphasize, you know, here another term called right to good and service. I understand in some scenarios it is very useful. But on the other hand, you know, apply these notions in many circumstances may result in more difficulty to distinguish between principal and agent. I not have specific, very detailed concern, but I have a broad concern about introduction of this, or emphasize this notion.
On the first point, I would just like to clarify that the term specified good or service is already there in the existing IFRS 15. Like if you see paragraph B34, it does refer to a specified good or service. What we just did is to use that term consistently across the guidance, because somewhere the term promise good or service was used, or performance obligation was used. So just to keep it consistent, we've repeated the word specified good or service across the guidance. So that's actually not a new term that was introduced through the clarifications.
And similarly, a right to good or service is existing terminology in the list of examples at the start, near the start of the standard about different types of goods or services. I think what we've just done is use that existing terminology and been very, very consistent about how it's been used in the principal agent guidance.
Okay, back to you, Russ.
Ray, do you want us to vote on 1 through 3? Okay, so I'll call a vote here on questions 1 through 3, then I'll turn over to Hans, and then we can talk about question 4. So at the FASB, I didn't hear any concerns about questions 1 through 3, so I'll just, does anybody, who votes the affirmative for questions 1, 2, and 3? So that's 7-0 for questions 1, 2, 3. Tom?
I have one observation on the specified good or service. What we do in paragraph 606, 10, 55, 36, or B34 is define that as a distinct good or service. And one way, perhaps, if there is a communication issue, is instead to refer to it as a distinct good or service, because we have guidance for thinking about how to identify that.
Hans, I'll turn back to you to call the vote there.
Okay. So we vote on questions 1, 2, and 3. Who can affirm?
So that's all in favor?
All in favor.
Okay. Mary, would you like to tee up question 4? Thank you.
So question 4 relates to the credit risk indicator. A number of respondents suggested that the boards eliminate this indicator from the guidance. The staff and some stakeholders think that the credit risk indicator will almost always be a weaker indicator than the other indicators, similar to how it's viewed under previous U.S. GAAP. The staff think that retaining the credit risk indicator may complicate the analysis, especially when the control evaluation may be less straightforward. For example, when other indicators relevant to the evaluation provide contradictory indications. The staff think that the indicators that would remain after the deletion of credit risk better support the assessment of control. That is at least partially because the indicators that would remain are likely to be more relevant to the assessment of control and therefore more easily support the notion of control. Additionally, the remaining indicators are considered by most stakeholders to be stronger indicators of when an entity is a principal. Therefore, the staff are recommending that the credit risk indicator should be removed from the guidance. So with that, I'll turn it over to the FASB for discussion.
Are there any questions or observations here? Larry?
So if we were to vote in favor of your recommendation, would there be a discussion in the basis that would at least say that the board considered it, acknowledged that it's a weaker indicator, but then go on and kind of explain what you just did?
Yeah, so we have in the basis already discussion of how we've changed the indicators. For example, in the ED, we deleted the commission indicator. So there's already kind of a section where we discuss the changes, so we would just layer onto that to talk about why we also removed the credit risk and bake in this rationale.
Okay,
Hans, go ahead.
Any questions here? Nope. Shall I vote straight away? Do we agree with the staff's recommendation? Yes, all agreed. Up to you.
Okay, here with respect to question 4, do we agree with the staff's recommendation to eliminate? That's 7. Okay. So we have some additional questions, so we can proceed to ballot. Is that right?
Yep. So these are FASB-only questions. Questions 5 through 8 are for discussion by the FASB and relate to our due process, including the benefits and cost analysis, including the board memo for issuing a final accounting standards update. So with that, we have questions 5 for 8 for the FASB.
Is there anything else we think we need to deliberate? Okay, seeing none. Any more information board members need? Okay. Who believes the expected benefits of this change justify the perceived cost? That's 7. Okay. And I think that would give the staff permission to ballot. Any objections? Since? Okay. Okay. Great. Very, very efficient joint meeting.
Russ, can I? I understand this is the last time that Scott Weir is participating in a joint board meeting. So.
He's
apparently going back to his firm as a partner. We wish him a lot of success in his future role, and we thank him for his dedication and enthusiastic work on revenue and leasing. So we wish you all the best.
Thank you. One other thing is my understanding this is also Kristen Floyd's last meeting. Kristen's a PTA, and she'll be returning to her home of Houston, Texas today, right? Following today? Yeah, okay, great. you're ending on a good note. Okay, well, great. Well, thanks, Kristen.
Okay.
So So with that, we'll adjourn the joint meeting and we'll take a 5-minute break and start our FASB only meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Bye.